Hey, Aiden here.
This is Mike.
We're here to introduce the first audio interview for oddballpilot.com. It's an interview with Paul Roderick, who's the owner of Talkeetna Air Taxi, based in Talkeetna, Alaska. They fly the glaciers in the Alaska Range, fly climbers in and tourists. It's a job that, from the very beginning of my flying career, I've been interested in and somehow haven't managed to ever fly in Talkeetna. So this interview is kind of talking to Paul Roderick about what it's like to fly in the Alaska Range, how he got into it, and why he's continued to be interested in it. Hope you enjoy it. Hello, guys. We're here in Talkeetna, Alaska. I had an uncle and aunt, my uncle Mike, my aunt Joanna, were up visiting Anchorage, and we decided to drive out to Talkeetna and sit down with Paul Roderick, who owns Talkeetna Air Taxi, and just have a discussion about what it's like to fly beavers and otters in the Alaska Range, flying climbers and tourists primarily. So, Paul, let's start with you. Just how did you, you know, where'd you grow up and how'd you get into the business?
I've forgotten all that stuff. let's see. I grew up in Connecticut on a little farm there, and my dad owned a construction company. And about at the age of 16 or 17, I decided there's got to be more to life than here in the trenches. Because it was basically excavator work, so I ran a lot of heavy equipment and that kind of thing. But I did have an interest in flying when I was young, so for my, actually 10th birthday, my dad got me some flight lessons, and so that's kind of how initially I got into flying.
Huh, what do you fly in?
In a 172.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, we buzzed over the farm and then just flew around, and you know, so that I didn't take it real seriously. I just took some lessons and then kind of, you know, followed flying a little bit here and there, but when it came time to kind of figure out what to do, you know, in high school, you know, when you're just like, all right, what are we going to do next here? You know, and I figured, well, we'll give aviation a try. So I researched basically, you know, places, mostly universities are where you could, you know, take up flying and, you know, on the aeronautical end of it. And of course, at the first year, I actually had it narrowed down to three, like Embry-Riddle, Daniel Webster, and then in Parks College in Illinois, which where I went to first. I went there for a year in Parks.
Oh, were these, this was, what year was this?
In 80, I'd say I left high school in 85.
Okay, this is a while 80, ago.
Yeah, 86.
Not to put an age on you or anything.
doesn't seem like a while ago, but yeah.
Were those pretty new schools then? I always thought Embry-Riddle, I thought the aviation school that I just always thought you came around in the 90s. Have they been around
for a while? Oh, no, they've been around for a while. And I'm not sure exactly what year they started, but they're there since the 70s. But even the campus in Prescott, they'd had since, I believe, the late 70s or early 80s.
Wow, okay. That's cool.
And then the Daytona one's older. But I went to the one in Parks. You know, it had a good reputation, and so I went there. And that'd been around the longest. I think it was in the oldest, you know, flight school there was, and like since the 20s or 30s.
So, okay. Yeah. That's a long time.
That's a long time. It had a history back then in the aviation, but I think the school itself, you know, they taught flying since the 40s or something like that.
So you end up with a bachelor's?
You end up with a bachelor's. It's called a bachelor of science.
Okay. And did you, at the time, did you thinking more airline work? Because most of the schools I would associate with going on to fly first grade or going to an airline.
Right.
Is that what you were thinking? Or
hell no. I wasn't really thinking airline. I was thinking maybe possibly corporate later on in life, but I wanted to come and just do some other type of flying, like in different parts of the world. Or initially I thought, well, maybe Africa or the Caribbean or, you know, just something that was different, or Alaska. Alaska was always kind of in the back of my mind.
Okay.
So even in college, I took a trip to Alaska just to see, you know, if that was going to be the place. So I went up, took the ferry, and went up through Southeast and said, yeah, I think this is going to work.
You've been here ever since.
Anyway, I got into climbing, and then you figure you got to come to Alaska.
So when you came up here to fly, did you have a job lined up, or did you just show up and start searching?
No, actually, after I left Embry-Riddle, I went to Parks College for a year, and then I went to Embry-Riddle for three, and then graduated there in 89. And then me and a few friends were kind of tired of aviation, actually, after that, just thinking about it and studying, and we're like, we got to go travel. So we went over to Australia and did a big bike trip, diving trip, and then we went through Indonesia and Southeast Asia. And so then I ended up spending the next probably a year, maybe even 2 years traveling to different places around the world.
Oh, okay.
Because then I got totally into that. Because then I realized my life was real small. Because growing up, in the U.S. in a small town, I realized I didn't know really that much about what was going on in the world. So I figured, I've got to go. Especially Asia. There's something about Asia that everything they do is different. The way their whole lives, the way they structure it, and the way they treat each other and family and all that. I could just see that it was just, I didn't know. Yeah, I got a lot to learn, so I was just kind of stuck on that traveling vein for a while.
Yeah, David. Well, a couple questions about that. One would be, how'd you get back into aviation after that?
Well, yeah, and then after that, I figured, you start running out of money. And what was nice is I could come back to my dad's business and then work. And then I did a little flight instructing here on the side. And when I would come back to the States, I'd run out of money. And then after a while, I was like, all right, well, I'm ready. And I kind of felt like I'm ready to get into aviation now. So I went back to Prescott, Arizona, and I got my double I.
Okay.
And then I got back into flying that way. And then I went and tried to find work around Prescott, and I couldn't. And then one of my ex-professors was going to hire me flying Grand Canyon. So I was moving in that direction, and I was getting packed up, right? Yeah. But then, just as life always works, we're sitting in a restaurant in Prescott, and in comes, and then you can look out at the ramp, and in comes this 150 that just looked like it just flown through Afghanistan, and it was just sandblasted and beat up, and you're just watching this. In Arizona, you're used to seeing pretty decent-looking planes, kind of coming through. And so this thing comes in, and we're like, wow, who's going to get out of this thing? And then this guy in a Nomex suit and a helmet and a visor gets out. He looked like he just got off some special mission. And he comes walking out of it, and we're like, God, who the heck is this? I got to meet this person. So he sits down a few tables after, and then I kind of finished up eating, and I went over and sat down with him and talked to him, and it was Jerry Jakes, who actually lived here in South Eaton. And he was down there in his 150 to get his commercial rating because he didn't have it. And he was a hunting guide and did a bunch of shows and rafting guide and all that, and was doing some shows down there. And he was like, you should come up. And I was like, I'd love to come up. And he's like, if you get me my commercial ticket, since you're a flight instructor, we talked for a while back and forth, I'll give you a ticket up there. And I was like, deal. So right then and there, everything changed.
So you,
and yeah, a week later, I was in Anchorage at his place, and we flew to Talkeetna the first day.
Nice.
And he had a Cessna 180 on skis. So it was in the winter. It was a year we got really big snows. The snow was piled high everywhere. Even along the side of the roads, it was piled up like 15 feet. I remember saying to myself, what the hell would live here? Who would do this? Would it look like you're a couple, you had to be like a snow road to get through here.
That was
the moose were all piled on the roads and the, and driveways, because they didn't have anywhere to go. They got like over 20 feet of snow here.
Wow. So that was your first impression of Talkeetna.
Yeah, but I could tell it was a cool place all at the same time, because Mount McKinley was out, and you were like, I didn't really know much about, high-altitude mountaineering. Mostly I'd done rock climbing, scrambling up peaks in some of the Sierras in Arizona, that kind of thing. But it was captivating, because then I met some of the local characters here, and I met actually the owner of Talkeetna Air Taxi at the time.
Who was the owner?
It was Dave Lee.
Okay,
so
okay,
I met him and a couple other people that lived here, and then you could tell, this was going to be a big place right away.
How much flight time did you have?
I only had, what did I have? I don't know, 600 hours.
Okay, so you're up here with 600 hours.
Right.
You have a job flying with Jerry Jakes?
Jerry Jakes, yeah. And just flight instructing and then general, because he had a 180 and a Cub, and then he did some guiding. He actually ran the Talkeetna River commercially, and then he did hunting as well.
Okay.
So I flew with him and did some instructing initially, and then some flying with him.
And then you got into flying up in the Alaska range. Was that part of that, or did
what happened was then another big event happened. Then I was hanging out at TAT, at Talkeetna Air Taxi, and I met some of the people. And I met actually Dave's brother, which was Donley. And then he had a brother come up from the lower 48. He wanted to go up McKinley, and then he was looking for somebody to go up with him. I was like, I'll go. And then, but I didn't have any gear. I had to go scrounge gear, bunny boots and sweaters and, you know, all kinds. I had like four wool sweaters, and then I found a Gore-Tex jacket and some hats, and I had to piece together the whole expedition.
So you're in at TAT.
In the TAT on the deck through that, yeah. But then that changed again because those guys had to get an earlier start than I could do. So they went up, and I was going to meet them up there. And then I met another guy, an older guy, Ted.
Okay.
Ted Gannon.
Yeah.
And he was there, and his partner bailed. He was going to climb the Cassine. And he's like, I'll just go up with you. And I was like, all right, well, I've never been on a glacier, and I don't know much about high altitude mountaineering. He's like, great, I'll teach you. And he's an older guy, and he's done some instructing. So I was like, perfect. So I was like, all right. He laid my gear all out, and he was like, this is what you got? So I got another sleeping bag so I could have two bags, and then he had some extra gear. And, of course, he had the tent and all the other stuff, and we pieced it all together, and then we went up. We only went up to 14. On the mountain, but it was a big learning curve, you know, just getting flying in and getting on the glacier and snow camping and crevasse rescue and, you know, all that stuff. It was like a mini mountaineering course in itself. And so then that lights the fire. Then you're like the flying and the climbing, and then it just kind of took off from there.
So did you go fly for Dave Lee then?
And then when I did some more flight instructing.
Okay.
And then about, I don't know what time of year it was. It must have been in like June. Dave's pilot had to leave. He had some family issue. And then I got a call just out of the blue. I was like, I need a pilot. And I was like, sure. And that's kind of how it all kind of came together. And so I went up with him. I remember I went up with him, you know, flew the airplane flying. But I remember my first landing, I was just like, came in just big bounce, you know. And I'd flown a 180, but 185 is a little different. And I just, you know, I didn't think I did really a great job landing. And Dave was like, all right, you're hired. I was like, well. And then we did some more training, and you know, ride with the feds, and you know, you just gotta remember, like, you know, I got a long ways to go here, but here I am with my check ride. And, you know, it went fine.
Were the first glacier landings significantly different from other type of landings, or they? It's just landing.
You know, the glacier landings, actually, I could do the glacier landings much better than I could back here at the airport for a while.
Okay.
Yeah.
As long as you get that.
Mostly because of the snow. Yeah, you get the cushion from the snow, and you're never marked out. I mean, it wasn't like I was doing anything radical. I'd go up on nice days. So back then, we did, you know, limited training, and then Dave was like, all right, we'll go up and do some landings on the glacier. I was like, you know, by myself. He's like, yeah, it's good. The sun's shining. Just head out up there. You know where it is.
Did you have any thoughts that you'd have the ski stuck in a crevasse and you'd be waiting for a pickup?
No, I didn't really know enough.
Ignorance is bliss.
Yeah. In a way. Yeah.
So you flew for Dave for how many years?
I think 6 years.
Okay, then you ended up buying Talkeetna.
Yeah, and then he ended up, his wife didn't really want to be, live in a small town. She grew up around here, and she kind of wanted to move out. And then, I think, you know, they were having some issues, and because, you know, the air taxes is so much involved in, you know, in his time, and it was kind of affecting the family, and so he decided to sell it. And then I was going out with an accountant at the time. And she actually, I mean, to her credit, she really put together, we worked on a business plan together. She said, you got to go to the banks. I mean, the banks, you know, I didn't have any money.
Right.
You know, I was just a line pilot for 6 years. And, you know, didn't have anything. I didn't have any assets. I mean, I owned a cabin on a lake, but I still load on that.
A typical line
so,
pilot.
So, and then one of my friends who I learned how to fly was president of a big insurance company, and then he flew up, and he helped put the plan together and kind of, you know, add a little extra like clout in a way to the whole process. And we all went to the banks and pitched it together, you know, and had a business plan out and spreadsheets for the next, you know, 6 years, and made it look really good. And we're all in our suit and ties and just visit all the banks, and they accepted it. It was amazing enough. And then
so that was the 90s.
That was in 96.
Okay.
And that's all. And then, I mean, back then the business was about two Cessna 185s. And then.
Well, you've seen it quite. Yeah. You've actually, as a climber, not just the pilot, your company and you pop up in a lot of climbing magazines. It seems like you've actually, your business model hasn't been to chase tourists so much,
right,
but to actually look at the climbing market and sort of aggressively promote Talkeetna Air Taxi as a company that likes to fly climbers.
Right.
And you've not only done that in the magazine, but you backed it up with finding, sort of pioneering different places to land to give climbers better access.
Well, yeah, my heart's always been, you know, in the mountains and mountaineering, especially since I came here. And that was always where, I mean, the scenic flight tours are great and they pay the bills and it's easy because they load themselves and unload themselves and you don't have to go to all these, you know, wild and crazy places or pioneer anything. And it's just, I mean, so it's a good split that way. The beginning starts off, the season starts off with climbing expeditions mostly in April, May, June, and then it moves right into the whole, you know, scenic season. So it's a good mix. But I mean, my interest was definitely taking care of climbers initially.
Right.
And unfortunately, the scenic flight tours ended up every year as word got out, because when I first got here in the early 90s, it wasn't much of a business in the scenic flight tour. We had to kind of piece together, you know, hiking, rafting, hunting, and all that kind of stuff, too. And it was, I mean, if you did a few scenic flight tours a day, you were pretty lucky.
Right.
And then as the word got out, mostly through climbers, they told, you know, you guys got to do this flight, and they'd have their families come up, and the word got out that this is one of the greatest flights you could do.
Well,
in the mountains anywhere, it just started to really progress. And then, you know, Talkeetna was growing slightly, and then, you know, booking agents were selling it more, and then later on, the cruise company started coming here, and then, yeah, it kind of just kept growing from there.
So your basic strips you land at for climbers and tourists would be the Kilton Airstrip and the Mountain House.
Right.
That'd be correct. And then, okay, those are,
and there are others, but those
out.
Are the ones that we mark them out really well. And then we kind of move, later in the season, we move to other glaciers late season.
Okay. And your standard flight, about 45 minutes out, 45 minutes back, 20 minutes on the ground?
Yeah. They're about,
where are that line?
Yeah, usually around an hour to an hour and a half of flight time, depending on the tour that you do, and about a half hour total on the glacier.
And you spend if it's nice out, you're going to fly a lot. You're going to do 4 or 5 flights a day. You go beyond that.
If it's nice out, I mean, you're going pretty much all day from first flight leaves at 8:30 and last flight leaves at 7.
Okay.
So you might do 5 flights, sometimes 6, depending on, you know, how much time, you know, you...
Well, it always seems pretty well organized in terms of if you're out, when you're coming back, I'll hear your pilots call in, and Annie or someone will answer up and say, okay, your next flight is, you've got half an hour before it leaves.
Right.
And then they know they grab lunch and they can fuel right up.
Yep.
It seems like you have that running pretty well, which,
yeah,
from a pilot perspective, is great. You know what's coming.
Usually you got a break in between. Sometimes you don't. I mean, we try to schedule about a half hour in between each flight, maybe 45 minutes.
Okay. I'm going to get back to the planes you have. You've expanded the business quite a bit, but let's start with like a pilot schedule. Do you have a set schedule for people? Do people work out their own deals? Or are people 5 days a week? Are they kind of available? How do you...
Yeah, most pilots are on 5 days a week.
Okay.
So some are on 4, and there's even 1 or 2 on 3. So, but we try to keep it to 5 days a week. We used to be 7 days a week.
That's what I always heard.
Not too long, yeah.
Yeah, it's like then when you're smaller.
Until maybe 10 years ago, and then when we were smaller. And then we realized you got to have a life. I mean, it was great, you know, your first few years you fly here, because you don't really want, that is the life.
You don't want a life.
You know, and you don't want to do anything else. But then as we got busier, we realized we need help, backup. You know, if you have a sick day, I mean, what are you going to do if you, you know, if you hire the same amount of pilots as you have planes?
So if somebody has a day off, you kind of leave them alone unless you really need them to fly?
Usually leave them alone.
Okay.
I mean, things happen. Sometimes you got to call somebody up on their day off.
Right.
I
mean, but if you do it once in a while,
people try not to abuse it.
Receptive, yeah. Cool. You've gone from those 2 180s that you mentioned, 185 that you mentioned,
right,
and you now have 2 single turbine otters, 2 beavers,
3 beavers,
3 beavers, and
2 185s.
That's quite an expansion.
Yeah, over
pretty good.
I don't know how many years, 15 years maybe.
And you've got the 1 PT6 powered. Yep. Otter, the 675 horse, and then your Garrett-powered Otter, which is close to 1,000 horse.
Right.
So, out of all those planes, which is your favorite to fly?
Well, probably still the 185 in the end. Yeah, just a plane that we're doing real good. Yeah, I mean, it's just, I don't know, it's kind of the first plane, it's a traditional airplane. I mean, it's all small, we used to fly here with these small Cessnas, you know, 185s for years. And then somebody, people kept telling us, you guys got to get Beavers, you got to get Beavers. And then finally, we all kind of started moving that direction. And
then, the first time I flew with you was, I think, 88 or 89. You had the two 185s, I think you had a Beaver. And that was the big news in Talkeetna, was the Beavers were starting to show up.
Yeah.
The two birds, two babes and a bird.
Right.
They had the first, they had a Beaver, and that was, Matt was excited about that when he flew it. And he's like, God, we got the Beaver, and put all this stuff in it.
We can finally load it up.
We can take a Hibachi, whereas the 185 was crowded. Now you've got the Otters where you can take. Have you noticed that people bring more stuff now?
Yeah, as we progress in airplanes, people brought more stuff, for sure. I mean, it's just, that's when you started noticing that bulk up at Costco with gallons of salsa, big bricks of cheese, and even pizzas, and, you know, just
trips that I have going in, 200 pounds a person.
Yeah. And then even we've had, and the French abuse it the most, because we had one expedition, it was like 8, where they flew in. They put their bread in these 50-gallon trash bags, and we had 4 50-gallon trash bags of bread. And then, you know, not to mention, you know, over 100 pounds of different cheeses, and of course, you know, it just went from there.
Well, you've been known for stopping randomly at camps and bringing in orders later on. Like, if you stop in, make sure everybody's doing okay, tell them the weather.
Yeah.
And if they, you did this for the French earlier this year, French came to Kilton Airstrip, where you are all the time. You bring in food or extra food if they.
We usually do. Sometimes we'll make our rounds, throw a few pizzas in the plane, and make your rounds and hand out some pizza.
Give everyone shit if they're not climbing. What are you still doing here?
I usually do that.
Get up on that thing.
No pizza for you.
Yeah.
You're still here? Yeah, do that.
So what you also, you kind of pioneered, if I've got this right, some of the other landing strips that have become popular, like the Root Canal, Tokositna. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Or
well, Tokositna, no.
Okay.
I've been landing in years past. But a few places like on the Eldridge Glacier and the Root Canal, which is kind of the more well-known one.
So you're actively kind of looking for other places to get climbers in and give them access to different mountains.
Exactly, yeah. And then climbers are usually the ones that kind of
plan.
I would say they plant the seed for going the new area the most. And then when I got into climbing, that's how I started going into Root Canals, you know, looking at places to climb.
Okay.
So, and that was a hell of a lot easier to access some of the climbs on the Moose's Tooth than, you know, trying to crawl up there.
I mean, the Moose's Tooth, with you landing there, has created a whole, I mean, in the climbing world, now it's an Alaska Range crag.
Yep.
It's not even an expedition. People fly up and climb it on a weekend if the weather's good, because you land them 100 yards.
You climb two or three routes on a weekend, where it takes you a week or more.
Cool, and you took in Jack Tackle, I think, last spring, into a east side of Huntington.
Yep, it was kind of another pioneer.
Think that's someplace you're going to go much more?
No, we decided. after I took them in and out of there, it was kind of a little, basically a hanging glacier on the side of Mount Huntington. And it's in a bowl, and it captures a hell of a lot of snow. All the weather that comes in kind of pushes up against the south side of Huntington and deposits right in this, which is why that glacier's there to begin with, because it just gets a tremendous load. If there's an inch anywhere else, there's a foot there. And if you get 2 or 3 feet, it just, just place it. Just,
and you, but you
it's enjoy, a cauldron, really.
And you enjoy that. I mean, that seems to be
something
we
like
really
it, yeah.
Enjoy.
Actually, when we landed them in there, fortunately, it was really good. But it was pretty deep snow, where everything else was perfect. You know, and you kind of sat up on the snow. And this one, we were still going a few feet. But, you know, and it's uneven and undulating and, you know, just doesn't have a lot of really friendly characteristics to be consistently working in and out of.
Is there,
you know, I think the only reason I'll go back there is if for some personal climbing.
And a lighter plane.
Yeah.
But you like the Otter. You like the Garrett-powered Otter for that stuff as well.
In the end, that airplane does the best. I mean, if it's really deep, any plane suffers, but this has enough horsepower to kind of drag itself out of the deep snow.
And the bigger skis drive over ruts better as well.
When drive over when it gets rut,
So that's something I hear from a lot of people up here, that you've probably watched the changes. The 185s used to be adequate, not just for the loads, but the glaciers were frozen. Now it seems the glaciers are drying out, and it's a lot rougher landing later in the season.
Yeah.
And the otters tend to ride through that better.
Yeah, since they have longer skis, you know, it's like a boat, you know, the same way. You know, you kind of crest over, you know, the rough stuff better, you know, like if a boat, the waves are 10 feet apart and you got a 20-foot long boat, you're in better shape. It's the same way on the glacier. We tend to rut it up, and then the glacier kind of moves, and it can basically form small crevasses or basically sun cups that are a big issue. So the cups are usually like big plates that are about 6 inches deep. And for a small ski, it kind of just chatters its way through there like an Cessna, but the otter rides right over them real nice.
Okay. Obviously, you're in Talkeetna. You've got a few operators here. Oh, I'm good. Thanks. So I'll munch on some later. If it's you and K2, Talkeetna or Tex, K2 seem to be the big operators. And Dave Lee's now opened up his Sheldon Air Service right next door. Do you think there's a pretty good relationship with everyone? People kind of work together? Or is it more cutthroat, you know, get out of my way type of?
Well, no. I mean, we all actually get along fairly well. There are times that things get a little tense. But it more has to do with, like, especially if years where the weather's bad and challenging, if we're known to be a little more aggressive and we fly more of the climbers than anyone else, so we end up trying harder and getting it out when sometimes other people don't, and that puts a little pressure, you know, on them, and then they take that pressure and try to, you know, push it over onto us and sometimes call the feds or saying we're, you know, flying it. Weather that we shouldn't, but sometimes, you know, with mountain weather, it's all timing, because, you know, within a half an hour or less, weather changes up there, and if you make it in, and then the next pilot behind you can't make it in, they just think you did something that,
right,
you know, wasn't, you know,
legal,
or wasn't quite safe, or whatever, and then, but the pilots that have been up here long enough know that.
And if you're not out there looking, you're never going to get in.
Well, exactly. So we actually end up putting a lot of effort into trying to get in. Now, we burn a lot of gas that way, turn around a lot, but, you know, we end up just, and I kind of feel like it's worth putting the extra effort into it.
It's more like the old boss I worked for. He never cared if we got in somewhere. He just wanted us to go out and try.
Yeah, take a look at it.
That's kind of more the attitude. Let's go see it. Good enough here in Talkeetna, right. So let's go see what we can see.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, as climbers, we appreciate that.
Yeah.
Sitting at base camp.
Yeah.
Say, yeah, Paul's launch is coming. Take a look. Yes. Yeah. He turned around.
Plus, we like to watch the climbers scramble and get ready, too.
Yeah, we know that. Then they're really ready.
Yeah, and then not come.
Do you, you probably have, but how often do you actually get stuck out of base camp or somewhere the weather comes in after you land?
Usually once a year, usually for climbers. I mean, on scenic flight tours, if there's any chance we're not going to make it back, we don't land. But with climbers, you know, they're self-sufficient. And we're just dropping them off there anyway.
Okay.
So usually the issue is we make it in but can't get back, and it happens once a year. Usually we just get stuck for a few hours. It's fog, but we have been stuck up there for, you know, an overnight or two.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you think as an owner it gives you more freedom to kind of do sort of your own thing? Like I was up there on the glacier and you flew us down, further down the glacier, dropped us off kind of on a whim. Now as a pilot, would...
One of my pilots did that. They might not be around.
Yeah.
Well, because, I mean, you try to... I mean, to keep track of all your planes, you don't want somebody to have complete freedom. We try to allow as much freedom as we can, but usually we have designated places that you go, and if you're going to go there, make sure you know and get prior approval from either the director of ops or the chief pilot, and, you know,
right,
at minimum. So.
And you at least can tell Lisa and basically.
And I can tell Lisa where we're going.
Or...
So usually we try not to do anything like that unless somebody knows where we're going.
Okay.
You know, like in your case, we only went down the glacier a couple miles, but still, it's a place that we don't land in, and it doesn't have any tracks, and you know,
right,
you're just a higher risk, usually.
You bring up risk. How risky do you feel the flying? Is it the inherent risk? Now, you can always make flying as risky as you want.
Right.
How risky do you feel day-to-day? I mean, I know the weather and all that fact. I mean, just how dangerous does it feel to you? I mean, you're aware of it, but is it...
I mean, it's... You know, it's always how far you take things and how much you're pushing either conditions or... you know, how much you have in an airplane versus what the, you know, the snow conditions are like or the wind. And so, I mean, the nice thing about it is you're, you know, let's say you're taking on, sometimes you feel like you're taking on about as much as you should take on.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, even you're on a glacier and you're light, sometimes you feel like you might be taking a little more on than you should.
That's
but, you know, you have to weigh out a lot of different things. And that, usually you get to that point after you've been doing it a while. But even when you're, you know, younger, there are times on glaciers that you're just, the snow is real sticky, you can barely taxi, you've made a runway, and you're like, I'm not sure if I'm going to make it off the glacier this time. And you're just still not sure. But the nice thing about it is you can abort the takeoff and unload and then taxi back up. You know, it's not like you go all the way. You know, most of these glaciers that we land on have a couple miles of room. Some of them don't. And those you have to decide right away whether the plane's going to fly or
right,
not.
Like Tokusitna.
Like on the Tokusitna,
yeah. Root canal.
On the root canal, you have to decide. You have to really know, because there isn't a lot of room at the end. You can't abort. None of us ever have, but you could, you know, and there's a way to do it. But you have to make that decision right within your first, you know, 5 seconds of takeoff.
So there's a lot of kind of personal judgments that you have to make
right.
Flying in there. It's not, you can't look at the book and say the book says I can do this.
I know, you can't. There's nothing right.
And you're, if you've got a snow condition that's going to depend, you might need to be 500 pounds under gross weight
right.
Instead of at gross weight.
Well, yeah, sometimes we fly. We'll put one climber in a beaver in a pack, and that's it. And that's about all it'll take. You know, because unfortunately with snow, as there's hundreds of different types of snow, you know, you got, you know, its temperature and what the crystals are like and whether it's deep, you know, how the, you know, the amount, I mean, we all know, I mean, when you're on skis, even mountaineering, you know, it'll ball up in the bottom of your skis, you know, there's just, so you have to really be, you almost have to be a snow scientist, really, you got to get out when you land on a glacier, you get out and put it in your hand and kind of sift through it with your fingers and look at it. And just see what you're getting into, whether it's wet or not. Sometimes it's wet just on the top and dry underneath or vice versa. And you kind of have to make a decision of what plane you're flying in, where the winds are, and, you know, what kind of load you're going to take. So it doesn't, in a way, I mean, there, you know, there's an element of, I wouldn't call it danger, but there's an element of uncertainty to it. And if you do everything right, you know, and you kind of stick to a certain few basic premises, I mean, it's not dangerous at all, I think. I mean, it's, you know, in a way, you know, when I'm driving down the highway here in Alaska and it's dark and there's moose around and there's other, you know, drivers or potentially drunk drivers, I kind of feel like I'm, like, more on the edge doing that than I am flying around the Alaska range.
So you'd say it's a considered risk.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have control over it to a large extent, you can control the some.
From risk management, yeah, I kind of feel like, after a while, you feel like once you've learned a few basic things, you can manage the risk pretty easily.
Right.
I mean, there are always things, you know, mechanical issues that come up that kind of, you know, add another element to it that may be hard to deal with. But amazingly enough, you know, the flying up here, you know, as far as mechanically, it's rare that we ever have any kind of mechanical. We blow a cylinder once in a while, maybe on a Beaver or one. Usually on a Beaver more than a 185. But
you got the turbines out.
But then we got the turbines, and really, once they're lit, they're going to stay lit. It's pretty rare that you have an issue there.
Do you ever meditate on the snow conditions before you land? Try to make it a little bit better.
Well, yeah, I guess I probably have. You know, it doesn't do much good, though, because almost whatever you think it's going to be like from the air, it's different from the ground. I mean, it's just hard.
Still working on it?
I think, I'm still working on it. Yeah.
So that's what you do. You come and you drag a strip.
Right.
And do a couple runs, usually when you're light,
right.
And pack it down, get a feel for the snow at the same time, I imagine, and get some idea, and then you get out and find it's totally different.
Yeah, and you get down there, and even when you slow down enough, it's different. Because, you know, the, you know, snow at 20 miles an hour is different snow than going from 0 to 20. You know, getting that initial acceleration. But some of the glaciers, a lot of them we go into, you can't drag them. You
right.
Just can't. You're just, when you're on final, you're committed. You're just like, well, I might get stuck, or I might have to spend another half a day in here making a runway snowshoeing here. Or, especially if you're pioneering something, or you know you got a tremendous amount of snow.
I know you told the guys the first trip you took into the Huntington this year, I think you finally told them, well, I'll take a sleeping bag because we're probably going to get stuck.
Yeah.
They had like 6 feet of new snow or something ridiculous. That worked out okay, though.
Yeah.
We came back out. So talking about judgment and figuring out how to fly in here brings up another thought, which is how do you find pilots and what are you looking for in a pilot? I guess let's start with what you're looking for and then move on to how you usually get people. Is it face-to-face or through the internet?
Right.
Word of mouth?
Well, usually we always have to meet the pilot. I mean, I don't think I've ever hired anybody I haven't, you know, met and sat down and had a conversation with. You know, usually you can tell, you know, by talking to them on the phone, looking at their resume, whether they have the experience or not. I mean, typically ideally we try to find somebody who, of course, has a bunch of tailwheel time and has their own plane. It makes a huge difference.
Okay.
You know, if they don't necessarily have their own plane, then it seems like there's another degree of, just a higher degree of training. You know, if they don't have a Cub or a small plane or a tail dragger or something,
right,
they like to go out. I mean, ideally, the clowns are like, our pilots would like to hire, like to go out and do things in the outdoors with their plane. And we have a good, you know, portion of those. You know, most of our pilots have their own plane. And if they don't, they really want one.
Yeah, I bet. Well, that RV4, oh, that's nice. Yeah, I think
so. That way is pretty helpful.
I called you before I got into guiding looking for a job. One comment you made right off the bat was that I had too much time. You told me that you didn't like hiring guys with that much flight time. And I know that you hire people with lower time a lot. And you said today you're looking for potential.
So, yeah, talent, really. I mean, yeah. Talent's the most important thing. I mean, we've hired guys with low time and their first glacier landings, you know, better than you can do. I mean,
right.
It's pretty impressive. I mean, some people just really have it. So, I mean, I tend to lean towards talent and the ability to progress.
And you bring them along. Imagine you sort of control how they do it and teach them how you do it.
Yeah, they do a lot of ride-alongs with us. They'll ride with us 25 times, you know, on ride-alongs before they actually get in the plane and land on the glacier. You know, you can get around and fly. You know, almost you can tell. You get them in an airplane and how comfortable they are in it, how they start it, how they manage it, how they taxi it. You can almost tell before you get off the ground, you know, whether somebody, you know, has...
can fly the plane.
Yeah.
And it's more just basic pilot skills. It's not as much flying the numbers like you would an airliner,
right,
stick and rudder type of flying. Seems like.
Yeah, it's more of a kind of a feel, I think, some people have. You know, and part of it being operating machinery and having the feel for what something's going to do and being intuitive about how the plane, what it's going to do next.
Right.
You know, because if you're intuitive at all with an airplane, I mean, you're kind of way ahead. I mean, you know, it's hard to be intuitive and jump in a brand new airplane, but, you know, a plane you haven't been in before. But some people are just, some people have that feel just right away. Some people don't. Some people really never seem to kind of get that feel, you know, and no matter how hard they work. And it's not their fault. It's just like whether it's just it could be a mental thing, it could be, you know, the physical.
And they might fly
hand-eye coordination. It could be, exactly. And they fly something bigger. Well, we've had pilots who flew for us for a season and then went to the airlines and came back, and we couldn't train him back. We couldn't get him back. Basically, we had to let him go. We just couldn't get him. They ruined him. They just destroyed his mind. Yeah. I mean, he just could not keep his head out of the cockpit. He lost the feel. You know, I'm sure if we spent more time with him, we could have, but we can only spend so much time with somebody. We're not really. I mean, I'm a flight instructor, but I don't do it all the time, and I don't really feel comfortable just showing, starting from day one on there. Right.
I mean, it's a business. You
exactly.
Can't spend 50 hours teaching someone how to fly. What do most of your pilots do in the off season? Because they fly 4 months up here. Is there a trend they all go down south? Or they hang out up here?
Some live here, and then others usually go travel. Lower 48 or different parts of the world.
Cool. And do you have much work in the winter?
And we're open all year, but we just keep a pilot or two on. That's it.
Okay.
And usually one at a time, sometimes two, depending on the year. But it's a pretty good life. I mean, usually between tips and salary and, you got about 5 months of flying, all in all, if you have been with us for a while, sometimes more.
Well, and you fly the Iditarod for a steady work in the winter. It's only a week, but it's that. Do you usually end up doing that, or do you farm that out?
Well, I've done a bunch of Iditarods, but I usually farm it out now because I had a couple kids, and I don't like to take off for too many days in a row.
Yeah, you've got a wife and a family. This is a pretty good job for a family guy.
It is. It's really good. Yeah. Yep, I'm here every day, every night.
But was your, we can edit this out, I'm just going to keep it going, but she was a climbing guide, right?
Yeah, she got it on Denali, that's how we met.
Cool.
Yeah. Lived here, a little longer than I have.
Excellent.
Worked out nice.
All right, well, I'm pretty good with that. You all have any questions? We got the Glacier Man here.
You asked him, how did he get pilots? You know, what he's looking for is what he just explained, but how do you actually find them?
Yeah, he said word of mouth.
Well, we don't, it's just word of mouth. I mean, we don't ever advertise. I don't think we have. For mechanics, we do. Mechanics are harder to pick up. But pilots usually get a steady stream of resumes. I mean, especially everybody, there's a lot of people know that Alaska hires a lot of pilots in the spring, and they'll just send out, a fury and
30 resumes,
like we've all done.
Have you gotten the resumes there as an astronaut? Sending resumes.
We've got some of them we save because they are just so good. I mean, we get the astronauts and the engineers, and they've been involved with, testing of everything known to man, and I mean, it is just, we've got West Point, they're not West Point grad, but,
Air Force Academy.
Air Force Academy, Naval Academy, all those guys, and
Did you like your path? Did you like Emory Riddle? Would you recommend a 4-year college for someone who wants just a flying job, especially a non-airline type job?
Well, I think the only advantage of getting a degree and going to a college and doing it is you never know where life's going to take you. And so the thing is, it is expensive, but I mean, it is worth getting a degree in some form or another, I think, in one's life. You don't have to, and you certainly would spend a hell of a lot more money, going to one like Embry-Riddle, relatively expensive. But if you did it on your own, and we have pilots who, just done it on their own with their, we don't require any kind of education. And sometimes that takes you in the other direction. they just corrupt you too. But getting you thinking a little more linear than you should think.
Right.
And sometimes education does that.
Well, it's very structured flight school sometimes.
It is a pretty structured place, and they're gearing you up to be an airline driver.
Yeah.
But they also know there's other types of aviation careers out there, and they try to, they do their best to kind of lay those out. But even when I was in school, though, nobody talked about bush flying. You had two types of people. It was the airline, corporate type, and then we had the Air Force Academy guys.
Well, so you were the odd duck out.
Yeah, and I was the one. Like when they would give talks on, the new, type of avionics, or the new, the F-18 that had just come out, and 16, or composite materials, and I was usually doing them on the bush pilots of Alaska kind of thing, and flying, the older planes, that kind of thing, landing on glaciers and rivers and, surf and that kind of thing.
Yeah, sounds good. Cool. Any other advice for someone coming to Alaska looking for a job?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just, if you want a job in Alaska, the one thing to do is first off, get up here and get a look around and see if it's something that really fits your life and your personality. Not everybody likes Alaska. Not everybody likes its rawness. Some people just don't ever get comfortable enough taking everything in, like the weather, flying in the mountains, and you're just not comfortable with it. And you have to be, I'd say, a little more on the adventurous side, and it helps to be a person who likes the mountains and spends time in the mountains. And secondly, buying a small airplane of some kind, whether it's a little, Taylor craft, two-seater, and really getting a feel for, what it's like to fly a small plane in Alaska. I mean, that would be first and foremost in my mind.
Excellent. All right, well, I'm going to turn this off, and next thing we'll do when you're done lunch is go out and look at an otter.
We hope you liked this interview. If you found it useful, visit oddballpilot.com, oddballpilot.com, for more stuff like it.